Without further ado, we will begin our first session of the conference then, and it's my honor and joy to introduce to you our first session speaker, Dr. Mark Cortez. Mark is widely considered to be one of the leading theologians in the area of theological anthropology today. Professor of theology at Wheaton College, Mark has authored numerous books on the doctrine of humanity, including Resourcing Theological Anthropology, Christological Anthropology in Historical Perspective, and Theological Anthropology, A Guide for the Perplexed. And all these books, these three books, are available in the bookstore, and Mark will be doing some book signings with others at the end of this session. Mark has also been on campus this week teaching a course in theological anthropology and doing a great job, and I'm looking for Mark and wanting to... There he is. I'll have you up in a moment, sorry. Following Mark's talk, Wes Hill and Brad Nassif will join us on the platform to engage the conversation. Title of Mark's talk is Jesus Christ, the Ground of Our Humanity. Please join me in welcoming Mark Cortez.
All right, thank you very much. I will admit that I adjusted the title of my paper just slightly, which I can do now that I'm standing up here because no one can stop me. And actually, all I did is I added a subtitle to kind of more accurately capture some of the things that I'm doing in the paper. So the subtitle is The Image of God in Irenaeus and Modern Biblical Scholarship. Irenaeus's Christological anthropology begins with the conviction that the only true image of God is that which we see in Jesus Christ. Such a claim will not appear terribly startling to anyone familiar with the relevant New Testament texts. After all, the Son is the image of the invisible God, Colossians 1:15, and the exact representation of God's being, Hebrews 1:3. Furthermore, Paul declares that God's purpose from the beginning was to bring his people into conformity with the Son's image, Romans 8:29. Almost all of the references to the image in the New Testament make explicit reference to the Son, making it clear that Irenaeus's claim stands on firm biblical ground, but also making it likely that many will hear Irenaeus's claim as relatively uncontroversial. However, as we delve more deeply into Irenaeus' position and precisely what he means by saying that Jesus is the image of the invisible, image of God, we will see that his position has some surprising implications for the image of God and for theological anthropology in general. In the first part of this paper, then, we will look more closely at Irenaeus' understanding of the Imago Dei, focusing on what he thinks about the identity of the true image bearer. Who is it that images God? And about the ontology of the image. What is it that images God? Here we will see that Irenaeus' understanding of the image requires him to say not only that Jesus alone is the true image of God, but that he does so in virtue of his embodied humanity. We will then see that Irenaeus draws from this the conclusion that the incarnate Christ is the archetype of humanity, the ground for the humanity of all of the humans. Many will worry, though, that Irenaeus' way of understanding the Imago Dei and the extent to which he privileges Christology in his interpretation undermines the coherence and the significance of the Old Testament texts that talk about the image long before Christ. Since they knew nothing of Jesus, does that require us to say that they also knew nothing about the meaning of the Imago Dei? When God declared that he would make humans in his image, was that an empty cipher? A mere placeholder for a concept that would have no real content until the advent of Christ. This relates to a broader concern people often have about a robustly Christological vision of humanity like this. If Jesus is the true ground of our humanity, was it even possible for people before Christ to have any real knowledge of what it means to be human? Does a Christological anthropology carry with it an implicit denigration of the robust anthropology we find in the Old Testament? Although answering this question in any detail would take us too far afield for one paper alone, we can take a closer look at Irenaeus' understanding of the image in relation to the Genesis texts themselves. In doing so, we will find that there is considerable resonance between Irenaeus' Christological interpretation and an increasingly influential strand of Old Testament scholarship on the image. This should at least give us a starting point for thinking about how to affirm that Jesus is the ground of our humanity while maintaining a high appreciation for what the whole biblical canon has to say about what it means to be human. So first, the who and the what of the Imago Dei. The first question we need to address in Irenaeus' understanding of the image of God has to do with identity. Who is the true image of God? Although Irenaeus does think that there's an important sense in which all human persons are made in the image of God, his answer to this question is quite clear. Drawing on those New Testament texts I mentioned above, Irenaeus insists that Jesus Christ alone is the true image of God. He makes this clear in his demonstration of the apostolic preaching, where he claims, quote, "For God made man the image of God, and in the image of God is the Son, after whose image man was made. And for this cause he appeared in the end of the times, that he might show the image to be like unto himself." In other words, while it remains true that all humans are made in the image of God, this is true of the rest of us only indirectly. The Son alone is the true image of God. All other humans are only images of this true image. Yet this provides only one part of the answer to the identity question, since it does not yet say anything about what it means to say that Jesus is the true image of God. When Paul declares that the Son is the image of the invisible God, to whom is he referring? For many theologians, the answer is clear. The eternal Son, who exists co-eternally and co-equally with the Father and the Spirit in virtue of his divine nature. This conclusion seems just obvious to many, given that Paul immediately declares that the same Son who is the image of the Father is also the one who is intimately involved in the act of creation. Consequently, the only reasonable conclusion seems to be that the Son refers to the second person of the Trinity in his divine nature. Theologians have frequently argued for a similar conclusion on the basis of the fact that only the divine Son could possibly serve as a perfect image of the divine Father, truly and fully instantiating all of the divine attributes. Yet Irenaeus' understanding of the Imago Dei requires a rather different conclusion. The Son is the true image of God in virtue of his perfect human nature. After declaring the Son to be the one that all other humans are modeled after, Irenaeus goes on to emphasize that this requires that a true human person possess a body, soul, and spirit. Yet that simply would not be the case if Irenaeus were speaking here of the Son exclusively in his divine nature. Instead, Irenaeus seems clearly to have in mind the incarnate Son in his embodied state as the one after whom the rest of us have been modeled. This conclusion follows from Irenaeus' understanding of the image itself. Although we will see in a moment that Irenaeus has what could be described as a multifaceted understanding of the Imago Dei, his basic understanding is that an image is that by which God makes himself visible in the world. Irenaeus alludes several times to Paul's statement that the Son is the image of the invisible God, taking that as a paradigmatic statement about the nature of the image. As he says, quote, "And through the Word himself, who had been made visible and palpable, was the Father shown forth. Although all did not equally believe in him, but all saw the Father in the Son, for the Father is the invisible of the Son, but the Son is the visible of the Father." Irenaeus thus locates his understanding of the Imago Dei within the broader framework of God's self-revelation in creation, maintaining that it is in the embodied Son that we truly see the Father. John Baer concludes from all of this, quote, "But as God himself is immaterial and therefore formless, the archetype of the image of God in man must be the incarnate Son of God." None of this suggests, of course, that Irenaeus would have rejected the idea that the eternal Son is a perfect reflection of and consubstantial with the Father's being. Indeed, much of Irenaeus' Christology focused specifically on refuting any suggestion to the contrary. Unlike some other early theologians, however, Irenaeus' understanding of the Imago Dei meant that he generally used the term image itself to refer to the Son in virtue of his human nature. It is in the incarnation that we see the true meaning of the Imago Dei, making visible the invisible God in creation. Well, now that we've established the who of Irenaeus' understanding of the image, we can turn our attention to the what. Many early theologians drew a sharp distinction between the body and the soul of the human person, contending that only the soul can properly be said to be in the image of God. The logic is fairly straightforward. Since God is spirit, John 4:24, any true image of God must also be spiritual. Even many of those who argue that the image of God involves the entire person, the body as well as the soul, did so in a way that emphasized the primacy of the soul with respect to the image. From what we've said above, however, it should come as no surprise that Irenaeus disagrees. He not only affirmed that the entire human person was made in the image, but he emphasized that the body was intrinsic to the very meaning of the image. As he says, man, and not merely a part of man, was made in the likeness of God. Now the soul and the spirit are certainly a part of man, but certainly not the man. For the perfect man consists in the commingling and the union of the soul receiving the spirit of the Father, and the admixture of that fleshly nature which was molded after the image of God. Indeed, although Irenaeus did not always distinguish between his uses of image and likeness consistently, he frequently reserved the term image for that which denotes the embodied dimension of the Imago Dei. Yet this does not mean that Irenaeus' emphasis on the body required him to reduce the image of God to the body alone. Instead, he affirmed as well that the likeness of the image of God includes both capacities, like rationality and free will, which he associated primarily with the human soul, and a teleological dimension of the Imago, whereby human beings are brought into ever greater conformity with the Son through the indwelling of the Spirit. We could spend considerable time exploring the fundamental importance of pneumatology for Irenaeus's theological anthropology, but here it will suffice to notice that Irenaeus argues that you cannot have a complete human person apart from the union of body, soul, and spirit, with this latter term referring primarily to the work of the Holy Spirit in the human person. As he says, again, quote, for that flesh which has been molded is not a perfect man in itself, but the body of a man and part of a man. Neither is the soul itself considered a part by itself the man, but it is the soul of a man and part of a man. Neither is the spirit a man, for it is called the spirit and not a man, but the commingling and union of all these constitutes the perfect man. Consequently, for Irenaeus, the body is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for the image of God. One question that arises in this context, though, has to do with the intermediate state. Like most early Christians, Irenaeus affirmed a form of substance dualism whereby the human person continues to exist, in some sense, as a disembodied soul between bodily death and resurrection. If Irenaeus also maintained that the body is intrinsic to the meaning of the image, this would seem to suggest the impossibility of humans continuing to be in the image of God during the intermediate state. Although Irenaeus does not answer this question directly, his understanding of the intermediate state itself suggests a way forward. On the one hand, as we have seen, Irenaeus is quite clear that the human person is a body-soul-spirit composite, and that no one of these three things alone can constitute a human person. This might suggest that Irenaeus would have to contend that even if the soul survives bodily death, the human person does not. Yet Irenaeus draws on the story of the rich man and Lazarus to argue that souls maintain the form they received from the body and continue to be shaped by the memories of the lives they lived in the body. There is then a sense in which, for Irenaeus, the human person continues to exist even in this disembodied state, but only because the soul has been indelibly shaped by its embodied existence. In other words, even in the intermediate state for Irenaeus, the body matters. If we apply the same reasoning to the Imago Dei, we have resources for arguing that the disembodied soul is still in the image of God in at least some sense. In other words, retaining the form and identity that is proper to being a creature made to manifest God's presence in creation, even during this time when the person is tragically and temporarily no longer able to fulfill that purpose. Now, the anthropological significance of a Christological Imago Dei. For Irenaeus, this way of understanding the Imago Dei has tremendous implications for theological anthropology, since it requires him to maintain that Jesus alone is the ontological and epistemological ground of our humanity. His ontological status flows from what we have just said about Christ as the archetype of all human persons. Even Adam was molded after the image of God that we see in Jesus Christ. This explains for Irenaeus what it means to say that Adam was a type of Christ. Adam is the one in whom God, quote, sketched out in advance the future economy of the humanity of the Son of God. As Mins points out, it would be easy to think that Irenaeus means no more here than that Adam's creation anticipates something that will not become a reality until the incarnation. Yet he goes on to explain, Mins goes on to explain, if we are to understand Irenaeus correctly on this matter, we will need to be aware that he understood the word type, when Paul uses it, in its literal Greek sense, that of impression or imprint. Adam does not simply prefigure Christ, but bears in his own body the lineaments of the incarnation of the Son of God. Adam was consequent on Christ, not the other way around. Consequently, Adam's humanity has been shaped in a very real sense by the archetype provided by the humanity of Christ. Now, this does not mean that Irenaeus completely downplayed the fact that Adam appears first in history, or that the biblical authors frequently refer to Adam as the historic head of humanity. Indeed, for Irenaeus, the full humanity of Christ is grounded in the fact that he too receives his humanity from Adam. All humans are human, insofar as they have received their particular form of being from Adam. As Irenaeus says, we are all from him, and as we are from him, therefore we have inherited his title, image of God. And elsewhere, for if he, Christ, did not receive the substance of flesh from a human being, he neither was made man nor the Son of Man. Without participating in the Adamic lineage, then, Jesus would have inaugurated a fundamentally different kind of humanity, rather than recapitulating and redeeming the humanity, the people who actually began with Adam. The Adam-Christ relationship for Irenaeus is thus somewhat circular. Both play fundamental but different roles in grounding humanity. Christ as the true archetype of what it means to be human, and Adam is the historical head from whom all others receive their humanity. Having established the ontological primacy of Christ in Irenaeus' anthropology, we can turn our attention to the epistemological question. It is important to realize here that the latter does not follow inevitably on the former. Indeed, in many cases, the order of knowing specifically does not follow the order of being. For example, it seems quite reasonable to maintain that the oak trees surrounding my backyard are ontologically dependent on oak trees that existed hundreds of years ago. Apart from those ancestral oaks, my trees would not exist. Yet if I wanted to learn about oak trees, maybe seeking to understand the twisted psyche that causes them to wait every year until just after leaf collection day to drop their little oak droppings all over my yard, I would almost certainly begin by studying the oak trees that currently exist. Indeed, I would likely operate under the presupposition that I can come to know everything I need to know about that which is ontologically primary, the ancestor oaks, by learning about that which is ontologically secondary, the current oaks. In the same way, there does not seem to be anything preventing us from maintaining that despite the ontologically secondary status of Adam's humanity, it might still be the proper epistemological starting point for theological anthropology. Indeed, it remains quite conceivable that one could know almost everything one needs to know about humanity without knowing anything about Jesus, while still maintaining that humanity is ontologically primary to that of every other human. However, Irenaeus argues otherwise. According to him, the Imago Dei requires us to maintain Christ's epistemological primacy as well. Irenaeus famously contended that Adam and Eve were created good, but not perfect. As finite and temporal creatures, they entered existence in a state of relative immaturity, where that word's not being used in a negative sense, with the intention that they would grow toward their ultimate telos of deification through union with the Son and the power of the Spirit. This teleological account of humanity flows directly from Irenaeus' understanding of the Imago Dei. Rather than viewing Adam and Eve as already complete in their status as divine image bearers at creation, Irenaeus contends that even before the fall, they needed to grow into the likeness of the Son as the archetype of their humanity. This leads Irenaeus to the conclusion that even though humanity was created in the image from the very beginning, we do not see what that truly means until Christ's advent. As Irenaeus says, for in times long past, it was said that man was created after the image of God, but it was not actually shown. For the Word was as yet invisible after whose image man was created. When, however, the Word became flesh, he confirmed both these. For he both showed forth the image truly, since he became himself what was his own image, and he reestablished the similitude after a sure manner by assimilating man to the invisible Father through means of the visible word. Consequently, as Hans Boersma summarizes, Adam and Eve give only a dim impression of what it is like to be the image of God. Yet if the Imago Dei is central to understanding humanity, and if it is only in Christ that we see the true revelation of what the Imago Dei means, then the epistemological primacy of Christ for theological anthropology follows rather directly. Now, what about biblical scholarship? By this point in the discussion, some will have noticed that we have said almost nothing about the specific details of the text that is our first introduction to the Imago Dei, Genesis 1:26, or any of the other Old Testament texts that bear on our discussion, especially Genesis 2, Genesis 5, Genesis 9. Indeed, given the strongly Christological orientation of Irenaeus' argument, one could argue that he is offering an interpretation of the image that is almost entirely foreign to these Old Testament texts. Colin Gunton was surely correct when he argued that the scarcity and inherent ambiguity of references to the Imago in Scripture means that, quote, we need more than an extended exegesis of Genesis 1:26 and following, and in particular a broader treatment of the topic if we are really to make satisfactory use of the concept of the Imago Dei. Nonetheless, Gunton also argued that this broader and more theological treatment must do justice to the text in question. And some might legitimately worry that Irenaeus' interpretation fails at precisely this point. Although many have criticized systematic theologians in general for neglecting the work of biblical scholars in their interpretations of the Imago Dei, which would suggest that Irenaeus would at least be in good company if he too made this mistake, arguing that everyone is doing it probably isn't the best way to defend Irenaeus' view of the image. Fortunately, though, an influential strand of modern biblical scholarship on the image offers far more support for Irenaeus' view of the image than is often appreciated. Looking more closely at the interconnection between these two approaches will not only help us gain a better appreciation of Irenaeus' interpretation in general, but may also suggest ways in which a Christologically determined theological anthropology can remain thoroughly committed to the robust anthropology of the Old Testament. It is fairly common to hear theologians lament the obscurity of the claim that humans have been made in the image and according to the likeness of God, pointing out that the texts themselves offer no definitive statement about the meaning of the Imago Dei or how it should affect our understanding of what it means to be human. According to them, it is the very silence of these texts on such crucial questions that has led to so many disparate interpretations of the image in the history of theology. Increasingly, theologians appeal to the notion of mystery to explain the image, suggesting that since humans have been created to image a fundamentally transcendent and mysterious God, we should not be surprised to discover the image itself shrouded in mystery. However, if we turn our attention to what the biblical scholars are actually saying about the image, we find a different story entirely. According to Gunnlaugr Jonsson, were it not for a few influential outliers in biblical studies, quote, we would be able to speak of a complete consensus among Old Testament scholars on the meaning of the Imago Dei. So it does not seem to be the case that Old Testament scholars in general think of the image of God as an intractable exegetical problem. Instead, even if they think that there is a theological depth to the Imago Dei that requires further unpacking, they speak quite confidently about the basic nature and meaning of the image in the Old Testament. To summarize, they contend that the language of image and likeness has to be understood in its ancient Near Eastern context, where such language was used to describe humans, primarily kings, as those who represented a divine being on earth and who rule over the earth in the place of that deity. They thus point out that the text does not simply claim that humans are made in the image of God, but it goes on to declare that these same humans will rule over creation, Genesis 1:27. Both the cultural context and the immediate literary context thus seem to support the idea that the Imago Dei describes human persons as God's representative rulers on earth. Yet there is an ambiguity here in this claim about a widespread consensus in biblical scholarship. Although Jonsson is correct to point out that a significant majority of Old Testament scholars focus on the relationship between the Imago Dei and the idea of representative rulership, it would be incorrect to say that most biblical scholars view the latter as a definition of the image. Instead, most contend that the grammar of Genesis 1:26-27 suggests that dominion is being presented as the purpose of the image rather than its definition. If we're looking for a place to focus our attention on a near consensus regarding the actual meaning of the image in Old Testament scholarship, it would appear to be the idea that the ancient Near Eastern concept of what constitutes an idol is the proper background against which to understand the terms tselem, image, and demut, likeness, in Genesis 1:26. Both of these terms, particularly tselem, need to be understood as part of a broad constellation of terms used in the Old Testament to refer to both idols and idolatry. David Kleins thus points out that tselem and its cognates, quote, are used predominantly in a literal sense of three-dimensional objects which represent gods, men, or other living beings. And Richard Middleton contends that the cultic background of tselem is so clear that, quote, any Old Testament scholar worth her salt will acknowledge that the semantic range of tselem includes idols. Although demut is used less frequently to denote idols, such a use is well within its semantic domain. Consequently, James Barr concludes, quote, there is an antecedent probability that the term image of God might suggest and might therefore require some delimitation against the then familiar use of images or idols of the divine. At this point, though, we are likely to be led astray by two significant factors. On the one hand, our Western sensibilities incline us to think of idols as merely symbolic representations of a person's or community's religious beliefs in some divine being. If I walked into your house and discovered an idol sitting on your fireplace mantle, I would be a little surprised by that, by the way, but if that happened, I would probably not walk over, pour my cup of coffee on its head, and knock it to the ground. This is at least partly because that seems like a waste of a good cup of coffee, but it's also because I would want to respect the idol as a token of your religious beliefs, regardless of whether or not I agree with them. But, and this is the important part, I almost certainly would not avoid shoving your idol onto the floor because I fear the idol itself. Even an important religious symbol for most Westerners is still just a symbol. It may have epistemological significance, but ontologically, it's still just a chunk of wood and stone. This framework is only reinforced by a number of rhetorically powerful but potentially misleading biblical passages, each of which emphasizes the futility of worshiping objects made by human hands, and they're scattered throughout the Old Testament. In one particularly sharp passage, Isaiah mocks the idolater by saying, half the wood he burns in the fire, over it he prepares his meal, he roasts his meat and eats his fill. He also warms himself and says, ah, I am warm, I see the fire. From the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships. He prays to it and says, save me, you are my God. Isaiah's great. All right. So Isaiah seems to be operating out of the same framework that I mentioned above. Although an idol might be important for its religious symbolism, the idol itself is just wood and stone. The problem with both of these perspectives is that they lead us to misunderstand the way idols were viewed in the ancient Near East, which in turn affects our view of the Imago Dei if the former provides the right interpretive framework for the latter. In the biblical world, idols were pervasively viewed as the actual physical means by which some divine being would manifest his or her presence in the world. To see this, we need to understand something of the process through which an idol comes into being. Ancient people were well aware of the fact that the process begins with something made by human hands. The craftsman selects the material, applies the tools, and produces the physical object. When the craftsman is done, though, we still do not have an idol. At this stage, all we have is a statue. For the statue to become an idol, it must go through a complex cultic ritual during which some divine being was understood to infuse its own divine presence into the idol so that the idol actually becomes a living creature. In a very real sense, then, the idol was not made by human hands. Although we might say that the statue was the product of human craftsmanship, the idol was the direct result of divine activity. Rather than being made, they often spoke of an idol as being born. Returning to the Genesis narratives, then, many contend that this cultic framework is how the terms tselem and demut would have been heard in the ancient world, explaining why these words could be used in the text without apparent explanation. They then find further confirmation for this interpretation in the way Genesis 1 and 2 portray the world as a cosmic temple created by God to serve as his own habitation. And the final stage in creating a temple in the ancient world was for the divine being to take up residence in the temple through the act of locating the divine idol at the center of the temple. People often focus on the idea that Adam and Eve were created to serve as God's priests in creation, an idea that is certainly present in the text as well. But we often overlook the role of verses 26 to 28 in the first creation narrative as that of enthroning God's idol images in his cosmic temple. And although Genesis 2 does not use any of the explicit language of the Imago Dei, several scholars have argued that many of the elements of the second creation narrative mimic the various idol-making rituals I mentioned earlier. According to Andrea Schule, we should notice at least the following. This is a quote. Similarities occur in the general pattern. The material shaping of a body, its being brought to life, the change of environment from some desert place to the garden, but also in details like the furnishing of the garden with plants and animals and the fact that God himself is present there and joins Adam and Eve in the early evening hours when there is a nice breeze coming in from the Mediterranean Sea. So in his argument, all of those parallel these various rituals in the ancient world for creating idols. If this is the case, it provides additional confirmation that we need to hear the language of image against the background of ancient Near Eastern views on the nature and function of idols, viewing the creation of the Adam in Genesis 2:7 as God fashioning his own idol in the world. This framework also offers an interesting way of approaching the reference to the Imago Dei in Genesis 5:1 through 3, a text that is often underutilized in discussions of the image. That passage not only reiterates the claim that humans have been made in God's image, but it also uses the same language to describe the relationship between Adam and Seth. Consequently, some have argued that this passage provides the clearest explanation of the image, grounding it not in capacities or functions, but in the kinship relationship. To be God's image bearers just is to be his children. As we noted above, though, ancient people also used the language of sonship, or say of birthing, to describe the relationship between an idol and the divine being who manifests presence through the idol. Rather than viewing kinship as an alternative interpretation, then, the idol view is perfectly able to accommodate this way of understanding the image of God. In the past, people have often categorized views like this as offering a representational interpretation of the image. Yet it is not clear that the language of representation adequately captures the robust notion of presence at work here. In many ways, the language of representation suggests precisely the opposite. If I was attending this conference as a representative of some other person, maybe somebody who couldn't make it this time, I would be doing so precisely because that other person is absent. That is what requires the representation in the first place. I've argued elsewhere for a more robust kind of representation that I called representational presence. Using the phrase to characterize things that are so closely related to the entity they represent that we could say that the entity was somehow actually present in and through the representative. For example, the relationship between a flag and the nation that it symbolizes. This kind of representation would move beyond the realm of pure symbolism and begin to capture something of the kind of real presence entailed in the concept of an idol. Yet I wonder if even this is adequate, since it seems that the kind of presence entailed here is more notional than real. The kind of representational presence involved in a flag only works for those who understand what a flag signifies. Without the requisite epistemic commitments, the flag is nothing more than cloth and dye. An idol requires a much more ontological way of understanding the presence of the entity involved in the idol. An idol remains an idol, even if no one knows that it's an idol. And this is because the status of the idol depends not on our epistemic commitments with respect to the idol, but on the ontological presence of a divine being in the idol. This more robust notion of divine presence sets the groundwork for understanding why the Spirit is fundamental to the Imago Dei. Since the Spirit is consistently portrayed in the Old Testament as the one who makes God present in creation, any claim that the image of God involves the presence of God is already a pneumatological claim. Despite the fact that the creation narratives say relatively little about the work of the Spirit in creation, many find indications of the Spirit's creational role in the Ruach hovering over the waters of creation and the plural pronouns used to refer to God. We've also seen reasons for thinking that Genesis 2:7 might be an allusion to the cultic ritual in which a divine being infuses his spirit into a material object. Both narratives provide at least some tantalizing hints that we cannot understand the Imago Dei fully apart from the Spirit who makes God present in creation. Putting all of this together, then, we have a significant and increasingly influential strand of biblical scholarship arguing that the idol framework prevalent throughout the ancient Near East is the only proper background against which to understand the claim that God made humans in his image, according to his likeness. If so, then we need to hear the Imago Dei as a claim that God created human persons to be the physical means through which he would manifest his own presence in the power of the Spirit. One question that often arises in this context is what to make of the Bible's consistent critique of idolatry in light of this interpretation of the Imago Dei. If the Bible condemns idolatry at every turn, and it does, how can it make sense to say that humans were created to be God's idols in creation? This question deserves a more extended reply than I can offer here, but two quick comments may help alleviate the concern. First, notice that the question itself introduced a distinction between idols and idolatry. In other words, it is possible to maintain that the fundamental problem is not with the idea that God can manifest his presence through material objects, something he actually does frequently throughout Scripture, but with the broken and sinful ways that humans attempt to limit and control God's presence through idols that they have created for themselves. This is how many understand the prohibition in the Ten Commandments against graven images. People often assume that the logic behind this command is that any attempt to create a material image of God is inappropriate, because God's transcendent nature cannot be imaged in finite creaturely realities. Yet others have argued for a different logic, one in which we should not create for ourselves images of God, because God has already established his images in creation. In other words, the problem is not with the basic idea of an idol, but with the idolatrous attempt to take control through the creation and manipulation of our own idols. Now you may well be wondering how any of this helps with the question of how Irenaeus' interpretation of the Imago Dei relates to the Genesis text. As far as I know, Irenaeus never compares the image of God to an idol, despite living in a cultural context that was in which idols played a pivotal role. Nonetheless, it only takes a moment to see that many of Irenaeus' most important insights about the Imago Dei find resonance with this way of understanding the Genesis narratives. First, both interpretations emphasize that the fundamental meaning of the Imago Dei has to do with God manifesting his own divine presence in and through these human creatures. Consequently, while we can still talk about the significance of the kinds of capacities, relationships, and activities that make us the kinds of creatures that we are, the real focus of the image lies on what God is doing in and through these image bearers, making himself visible in creation. Everything else we need to say about being human needs to be understood in light of that prior divine activity. Second, both interpretations place a high value on the whole person as the focus of the Imago Dei, and consequently each emphasizes the fundamental significance of the body. Indeed, the idol view makes it even more explicit that one cannot truly be an image apart from having some material form, since materiality seems rather necessary for an idol to function as an idol. At the same time, though, a third point of resonance arises from the fact that both resist reducing the human person to materiality alone. Instead, the idol and the human person both come into being only in the fusion of the material and the spiritual, the natural and the supernatural. Far from being an alien imposition on an ancient text, then, Irenaeus' interpretation of the image overlaps considerably with many of the best biblical research on the Imago Dei today. Irenaeus' Christological reinterpretation of the image does not require him to maintain that it was not possible to say anything true about the image before the incarnation became a historical reality. Instead, as we noted earlier in our discussion of the Adam-Christ relationship and the idea that Jesus is the archetype of all humanity, that is an incomplete sentence. finishing it would be... that it virtually requires him to say that truths that we know about humanity from Adam on are always already truths grounded in the reality of the incarnation. Consequently, while the humanity that we see in Jesus might still transcend and challenge our existing conceptions, we should expect significant continuity as well, particularly with the anthropology of the Old Testament. And that is precisely what we see in Irenaeus' understanding of the Imago Dei. Thank you.
We've got a few minutes before our respondents will come forward. So are there any questions of clarification for Mark specific to his paper not questions of extending implications, but clarification of anything you might have said that you'd like him to tease out a little more. Esau.
You mentioned Irenaeus' account of Adam being immature versus the more, I guess, Stanley's notion of Adam being made more perfect. I don't know if I heard you say which side you fell on, or does that matter as far as you're doing in the paper?
Yeah, I'm actually inclined to think that some kind of progressive notion with respect to Adam and Eve is intrinsic to actually how most people need to think about Adam and Eve, because at least at the very least, we have Adam and Eve as capable of falling in a way that we don't typically think will be true in the eschatological state. So I think virtually everyone has some kind of trajectory going on. Now, Irenaeus, of course, has a larger trajectory than is typically the case, right? So you don't get some of the really lofty language of Adam possessing basically all of the capacities and exercising to the fullest extent possible. But the basic idea of there being a trajectory move from Adam into the eschaton, I'm quite comfortable with. And then it's just a kind of a conversation about how much is involved in that trajectory, how much growth do we think would have been a part of Adam and Eve, even in a state of goodness apart from the fall. I kind of like a lot of the early theologians kind of had some of them weren't even hesitant to use the language of Adam and Eve being perfect, but then being able to become more perfect. And I guess the analytic side of me doesn't like using words that way, but there's a part of me that kind of resonates with some concepts are just hard to explain without using words in weird ways. So, yeah. Yeah, so the idea there being that, so Irenaeus uses really kind of the language of Jesus in his embodied humanity being the model, the archetype, and in that sense then being the ontological ground. You kind of get the impression that if Irenaeus were to kind of speculate about the order in which God's thoughts went in creation, which Irenaeus would never do. But if he were to do that, it would go kind of something along the lines of, I'm going to make Jesus, and then that will be the basis upon which I kind of create this vision for human community. So that Jesus himself, and again, by that meaning the incarnate Christ, is the starting point. Keep in mind that some of that, again, is me kind of teasing out where I think Irenaeus would likely have gone, because Irenaeus is not into that kind of speculative, kind of asking questions about what ifs and what might have beens.
Any other questions for clarification? All right, if I could invite Wesley and Bradley to come forward. Mark, why don't you sit here, and since you're already mic'd and you're there.
Yeah.
So Wes and Brad, you've both done work in theological anthropology. We're going to be hearing papers from you shortly, and you'll be introduced properly at that time. It seems to me that it might be appropriate either to begin with the Bible, and Wes, that's your area of specialty. But if one of you is eager to jump in with the initial question, I'll defer to which one.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. Well, the first thing to say is thank you, Mark, for a remarkably rich and stimulating paper. I found myself taking all kinds of notes during it. But I think the first thing that strikes me about what you've done in this paper is, from my perspective as a New Testament scholar, Irenaeus is sometimes treated as the source of many ills in New Testament scholarship. And the argument goes like this. What we find in the New Testament is a kind of dramatic rupture, a kind of inbreaking of the kingdom of God, the Christ event as the new thing that disrupts old structures. And you'll find a lot of New Testament scholars saying Irenaeus presents a much smoother, kind of progressive linear development of salvation history. And what I think your paper showed is that that's actually a fairly facile reading of Irenaeus, that he actually is far more sophisticated than that. Christ is the wellspring of creation itself. He's the source of the salvation history that we see in the Old Testament. So there's a kind of caricaturing, I think, that might be going on in New Testament scholarship in that way. So I found your paper salutary, and I found myself wanting to give it to other New Testament scholars that I know. The other thing I found myself thinking of is that wonderful line in Church Dogmatics 1:1, where Barth says that Trinitarianism was a battle for the Old Testament, not against the Old Testament. Which sounds a bit counterintuitive, because we often think, well, the Old Testament gives us monotheism, and then we've got to figure out how do we fit Jesus into that, because he's kind of, you know, it seems like he's contradicting monotheism when he claims I and the Father are one, you know, this kind of thing. But what Barth saw is that, no, the reason the doctrine of the Trinity gets hammered out is because we can't surrender the monotheism of the Old Testament. So this is a deeply kind of canonical doctrine. It's not just a New Testament doctrine. It's a Old Testament and New Testament together. And again, I thought your paper just kind of exposed that insight really, really nicely. I suppose the question, I have a couple questions, and this is just me kind of thinking out loud and trying to tease out what you've given us in this wonderful paper. The first question would be, you know, I think for many of us in kind of conservative evangelical environments, I know this is true for me, in the wake of all of the revision that's happening with our doctrine of humanity, think for example about the redefinition of marriage that's happening in Western cultures, think about the really kind of deep problems in bioethics and things like this. I think in our anxiety to try to give a Christian counter witness to some of these things, a lot of us are turning very quickly to so-called natural law arguments. I think, for example, the work of Robbie George and Ryan Anderson, I mean, I've learned a lot from these myself, but you've given us a really robustly Christological way of thinking about humanity. And so I'd just be very interested to hear how you think that work might fit or not fit with some of the natural law approaches that are so popular today. And then I guess maybe the second question would be more methodological, and this very much flows out of my own work. I mean, I noticed when I finished my book on Paul and Trinitarianism that the Paul I presented in that book sounded a lot like the Church Fathers in terms of his conclusions, but the exegetical arguments I used to get to those conclusions were rather different than what we find in the Fathers. And I think what you've done, you ended up really agreeing with Irenaeus, but you get there by way of some fairly sophisticated recent Old Testament scholarship that Irenaeus wouldn't have presumably recognized or engaged with. So I'm just curious about, you know, I do my work as a theological interpreter of the Bible, and I find myself wondering, you know, what is the significance of the fact that I come to creedal and confessional and orthodox conclusions that look very, very traditional, but often the exegetical moves that I make are rather different. You know, I'm making use of historical critical scholarship and things like that, if that makes sense.
That's
just something that I found myself pondering. But thank you so much for a wonderful paper.
Thank you for that. On the natural law question, but there's lots that we could kind of unpack and tackle there. I will admit that there's a part of me that does tend to be a little bit nervous about the extent to which we're beginning to rely on natural law arguments for a variety of reasons, but one of which is that it's really easy to baptize existing ways of thinking with kind of natural law kind of frameworks. I think you get where I'm going with that. And so it just, I never say no to it. There's just always kind of a little bit of hesitancy that I want to slow down the conversation on those. But I would be inclined to say that there's nothing about Irenaeus' Christological anthropology that would require somebody to reject natural law arguments. He would simply argue that insofar as those natural law arguments work, they're Christological. Right, because Christ was the ground of creation in the first place, so he would have Christology would have a role to play in probably assessing a lot of those natural law arguments. If you're going to put something forward, then Irenaeus is going to come alongside with Christology, as I would think anybody who would want to do a natural law argument would be open to doing. And his Christology is going to play kind of an importantly critical function in that, right? If Christ is the ground of creation, and if this is a legitimately natural law argument, then there has to be correspondence between the God that we see revealed in Christ and this law that we think we see revealed kind of in creation here.
Is the Christology almost kind of evaluative in that sense? Like when presented with a natural law argument, as Christian theologians, do we assess the persuasiveness and fittingness of that argument based on our Christological convictions?
I think it's at least that.
Okay.
And I'll admit, kind of as I've used Christological anthropology to do things, it has been more that negative move, kind of the critical function of it. I'm still trying to imagine in my own head exactly all the ways in which a Christological anthropology makes more constructive moves, but it at least has that kind of critical function to it. Yeah. On the relationship between kind of exegesis and theology, I feel exactly what you're saying. On this one, and actually you may have kind of a similar story on some, I actually came to my conclusions about the image of God first on the basis of kind of engaging biblical scholarship and research. So my landing point was an exegetical landing point. And then as I was talking with people about this, I had a number of people say, hey, you should probably read Irenaeus. There's some stuff in here that you might find interesting. I actually didn't for quite some time. Then I'm finally like, okay, enough people that I trust keep telling me you need to do this. And I got in here and went, oh, this guy's really smart. And there's lots of interesting things here. So my worry would actually be, so oftentimes the worry is you have a commitment to a theologian, a theological position. And so now I'm reading these texts or these biblical scholars in the ways that I need to, in order to kind of save my theological heroes and whatnot. If I have a worry in this one, it's probably going the other way. Am I reading Irenaeus the way that I'm reading him? Because I think this, he says some things that sound like this, and so then it's easy to just kind of put all the pieces in all of the right kinds of places, and I would be open to hearing that I've done that, and yeah, so.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Brother.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. I have read some of your work, Mark, and I want to thank you for being so clear and helpful. I think you've provided some of the best and most readable work on Christological anthropology I've probably seen. I wish I had read your work when I was studying with Father John Meyendorf, because years ago I had several Christology classes with him, and I saw this same pattern emerging, but I never saw it expressed as clearly as you've done. So thank you for that. I think you've done us all a tremendous service in clarifying the topics. What I want to do is to focus on something that combines both theology and Christian practice, and you can feel free to get beyond Irenaeus if you like. But the question that I have is a theologically difficult one, but on the other hand, it's very, very practical. Because, for example, in Hebrews chapter 4, the author tells us that Jesus was tempted in every way as we are, and yet without sin. As a human, we are all born damaged because of the sin of Adam in one way or another, and I know there are different theological interpretations of that, but something we all agree on is that we're born into a broken world, and we have wayward wills. Our wills are not properly aligned, and we are inclined to the various sins of the flesh, of anger or lust or disunity or even laziness and self-centeredness. So when we look at the inner being of Christ and what exactly it was that he assumed in the incarnation, there's a theological question of did he assume a fallen or an unfallen human nature. When we look across the Greek patristic tradition, it seems pretty clear that the Greek fathers were of the view that Jesus assumed a fallen human nature, that the if you look at particularly at St. Basil the Great, Maximus the Confessor, St. John of Damascus, they were operating on the assumption that Christ assumed a fallen nature. And I can give you quotes on any of this as you want. And particularly St. John of Damascus dealt with the heresy known as Aphthartardocetism. Another one.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get that one? That's another one, like the monophysitism and Apollinarianism and Nestorianism. That's less popular known. I'm sure you're probably aware of that. But the point of the Aphthartodocetus, which John refutes in heresy number 84, is that the Aphthartodocetus were saying that Jesus only seemed to be liable to death, and that he was actually born with a perfect human nature, and that if he had not willingly chosen to die, he would have lived on and on and on. So John refutes that. And the point here, though, that I would like to make is, and I would be interested in learning from you as to if you've given any thought on this question because of its practical relevance, is simply this. Did Jesus assume in the incarnation, did he assume the inclination to sin? If he didn't assume if we accept the fact that it's a fallen human nature, what about the precise nature of the will that he assumed? Did he, in other words, take in himself a bent will, a will that's wayward? And if he didn't, how can we honestly deal with the text in Hebrews 4 that says that he was tempted in every way? It seems like the real problem, I don't know about you, but I'm speaking for probably all of us, is that we have a warfare inside of our hearts, and we are prone from this inner inclination. And if Christ did not assume that, as Gregory Nazianzus would say, whatever is not assumed is not healed. So what are your thoughts on that?
There's kind of a snarky side of me that wants to like sell books. So my last book, the Resourcing Theological Anthropology book, chapter 4, that is the topic for chapter 4. And it's actually one of two chapters in the book where I surprised myself, because I do come out of a theological tradition that generally would not affirm any kind of a fallenness view. With the fallenness kind of language, you always have to distinguish between what kinds of fallenness we're talking about. Kind of earlier on talking about like death and kind of physical infirmities and whatnot, lots of people are comfortable saying that Jesus assumed that kind of fallenness. So that he's experiencing the consequences of sin without actually being guilty of sin in any way. Just as actually by entering into a broken and sinful world in any way, shape, or form, he would have experienced many of the consequences of sin, right? He experienced hatred and all those kinds of things. So the theological background that I came from would have been very comfortable saying he experienced that kind of fallenness. The actual draw towards sin, right? That inclination towards sin, that side of fallenness, my theological tradition, conservative, Baptist-y, kind of broadly, FYI, in case that didn't come out earlier, would be very nervous about that, because generally speaking, it understands any inclination towards sin is itself culpable, not just a consequence of sin, but that for which we are liable and blameworthy and the things that go along with that. So I wrestled with the various kind of positions for fallenness, and there are also various kinds of unfallenness and kind of where that all goes along. Ended up actually arguing pretty much what you're arguing for. Though not for the same reasons that people do when that which is not assumed is not healed kind of argument. I found that one less convincing because at least as it gets used by Nazianzus and others, that has to do with making sure that Jesus has fully assumed to himself everything that's kind of ontologically necessary for being human. So he has a human will, he has human affections, he has human body, right? Everything that's ontologically necessary to qualify as fully human, he's got all that stuff. But that doesn't say anything about whether or not any of those needs to be shaped one way or the other, right? It doesn't say that it has to be a fallen will that he assumes. It says it has to be a human will that he assumes. So I didn't find that particular mode of argumentation terribly compelling. It was the Hebrews 4, and particularly the relation, well, not just Hebrews 4, it was really the argument of Hebrews, and particularly the way that the author of Hebrews seems to use the argument where it's not just that Jesus was tempted in every way that we are, but specifically the way that it connects the temptations to the statement that he might be our merciful high priest. And it was that word merciful that I kept coming back to, I had a really hard time kind of wrapping my head around. If he's tempted, but in a fundamentally different way than I'm tempted, I don't get how that makes him merciful. So a lot of people arguing on the other side of things will say, like, being tempted in every way means coming into situations where it's technically possible that he could have performed any of a variety of sins, but without actually feeling the desire, the attraction toward that sin. And so in the book, I use the example of pickles for me, because I don't like pickles in any way, shape, or form. So I imagine that my wife and daughters who love pickles, they take off for the weekend, and they leave a full jar of pickles at home with me. And then tell me not to eat the pickles while they're gone. Okay, right. So now, technically, that qualifies as a temptation-ish, right? Because there's an opportunity to do that which I have been told not to do. But there's no temptation, at least as I generally understand the word. Like, there's no resistance there. I've even heard people use the language of, well, Jesus was tempted far more than anyone else because he resists, because he never gives in to the temptation. So he experiences far more temptation than the rest of us. I'm like, I don't care how long you leave those pickles in that fridge. I'm not eating the pickles. It's just not going to happen. And so if that's what Jesus is going through, I don't get how that makes him merciful. And so it was just kind of trying to hash that out. So I ended up trying to argue that there is a way in which Jesus can experience the inclination without that being culpable. And that gets tricky, and I used some thought experiments that involved appealing to Jack Bauer in 24 that we can get into later. But yes, that is where I landed.
Yeah, well, thank you. That I think that is helpful. To think of the pickles as not being appealing. You know, you have no appetite for it. That raises the question then, if Jesus had no appetite for the pickles, and we do, we're in a pickle.
On that note.
Okay, any follow-up questions based upon what we've had thus far from either of our...
Yes, I will go on. Maximus the Confessor, he spoke of, and he's very complicated, and so I don't, if you've not done Maximus, no problem, because he's hard to read. But in his work, he talks about Jesus having a natural will and a gnomic will. And the natural will, he, in simple terms, if you can reduce him to something simple, natural will is simply the appetite or the inclination, like a fish in water is inclined to go for the food, things like that. That's the natural will, following our nature. The gnomic will, however, is the deliberative will. It's the will that struggles. And Maximus starts out early in his career saying Jesus had a gnomic will. He did struggle. He questioned, should I or should I not obey? But then later he changes during the Christological debates with the Monothelites, that he says, no, Christ had no gnomic will. He had a natural will, but not a gnomic will. And there again, we're in another pickle, because what do you do if Christ did not struggle, as in the Garden of Gethsemane? Father, let this cup pass from me, but if it not your will, not my will, but yours be done. So have you ever thought in those Christological terms, and any light you can shed on helping us to understand Maximus's problem that he raises?
Yes to the first and no to the second. Yeah, I've engaged Maximus more secondhand through Ian McFarland's work primarily, and he has gotten into those kinds of discussions. So I have kind of more followed that from a distance and appreciated how complex Maximus is without actually attempting to read him for myself. on the whether or not I have anything insightful to add, that's where the no was. Other than it does, you always want to be careful about just assuming that Jesus' experiences are like our own experiences, and that I'm just kind of projecting out onto Jesus, or more importantly, kind of the divine nature itself, because this is how I do things. But it does seem to take the temptation worry and broadcast it out so that it now includes not just the decisions that Jesus made with respect to sinful temptations, but all of Jesus' decisions. Because I can't really make sense out of what it means for a human to will non-deliberatively. And so now all of Jesus' decisions are fundamentally unlike my own. That would be my worry, but it's a completely unthought-out worry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's time now to open the floor for questions for either Mark or either of our respondents. If you'd please come to the microphone to do so, so that your question can be recorded and then the response, which is also being recorded. All of these sessions will be available in audio. I think Mark's public lecture tonight will be available in video later on for your revisitation. So don't be shy.
This is for Mark, but I don't care who answers it.
Wes will answer it.
Yeah. When we talk about the inclination to sin, and specifically the Hebrews passage that he's as we were, but without sin, could you reflect just a little bit on the temptation stories of Jesus that in the Synoptics, and what that can show us, if anything, about Jesus' nature and our nature?
Mm-hmm. Before I get to that, I want to back up just one second. I forgot to say when responding to Brad about what I did on the fallenness stuff. I also did argue in that chapter that the position I landed on, I did not think was necessary for developing a Christological anthropology. So I kind of laid out there, you can disagree with me on this, and just your Christological anthropology is going to look different at the end of the day than if you kind of go down this path here along the way. But I think I'd be inclined to, kind of, if I'm looking at the temptation narratives, if we're going to see those as legitimate temptations, and that is the language that it uses in those narratives, that I'm still going to struggle to understand precisely what that means apart from there being some type of deliberative process that involves the kind of struggle that just seems entailed in the language of temptation, such that he can be merciful. Now, I realize the temptation narratives don't talk about that. But then the gospel narratives almost never talk about what's going on inside the mind of Christ, right? I don't know that much about ancient texts, but they don't seem to do that kind of thing very often. They focus much more on kind of the perceivable than they do kind of speculating or offering insight into the psychological. And so that we don't get a deliberative narrative in the temptations, that doesn't surprise me too much. Yeah.
I'd like to go to your comments about the representational presence from that part of your paper. And I'm wondering, I kept thinking about sort of the ancient notion of participation and a kind of participatory ontology, and wonder if that does some of the work that you need there at that point, right? And it has a long and storied history, obviously, then through not only sort of Hellenistic thought, but then through the patristic and intervening tradition. So I'm wondering if that's kind of what you're driving at, this idea that the image in some sense participates in the reality of that which it images.
Mm-hmm. The short version is I'm actually working that out. So my current research project right now is to try to figure out what in the world I'm doing with this language of presence, which is, of course, just it's a challenging theological concept in its own right. And then particularly to work out some of the, like, if we're going to say this about what it means to be human, that it's about the kind of divine presence, how do we differentiate human and non-human? If God is omnipresent, what am I saying is unique exactly in this kind of imaging relationship? What significance does this have for Christian, non-Christian, particularly if I'm emphasizing the role of the Spirit in manifesting presence in, and I want to say all human persons. I don't think the image is lost as a consequence of the fall. So now I have kind of a pneumatology question, kind of Christian, non-Christian. At some point, I'm going to have to figure out how this relates to concepts of real presence as it relates to the Eucharist. There's a robust iconography in the Eastern Orthodox Church that uses a lot of kind of similar. So I've all these kind of swirling neighboring conversations that I don't have worked out yet, but the language of participation would absolutely fit within that. Yeah.
I had a question regarding, I guess, the term perfect human nature. I guess two concerns, one being how do we talk about perfection with Jesus before the resurrection? Because isn't there some sort of, you know, eschatological transformation happening there? And then what do we talk about in terms of human nature? How can we have that in conversation? Do we have to assume some sort of tripartite anthropology? Is there... what really constitutes a human person and what is present there in Scripture and what do we have to work out theologically, philosophically?
I'm going to hold you so they can have you redo that second question for me in just a second. Let me answer the first one first so I don't forget about it. The language of perfection as it relates to Christological anthropology, that does get you back into some of the fallenness, and that is one of the implications there, that if you're going to, as you kind of tease out how that affects the way that a Christological anthropology works. Because I landed where I did on that particular issue, I end up arguing in the resourcing book that a Christological anthropology is primarily focused on talking to us about what it means to be human now, and isn't primarily focused on trying to give us some type of revelatory insight into what eschatological perfection will look like for a human person. The language of perfection in that context will be bounded in a way that it might not be if you have a different understanding of what Jesus assumed in the incarnation, right? If you do think that's much more of a perfect form of humanity, and if you're a little bit more interested than I am in speculating about what conclusions we can draw about the post-resurrection appearances regarding true humanity, then you might be a little more invested in a Christological anthropology kind of gives you this eschatologically ideal kind of move, but that's not where I went.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions?
The other question had to do with what constitutes the human nature as far as, because there's a lot of conversation on that, I guess, is it Joel Green who talks about, like, is there, like, talking about, you know, the question of the soul and whether.
My doctoral work, this is actually kind of how I got into this Jesus-y stuff in the first place, my research question kind of coming into my doctoral program was, does Jesus matter for theological anthropology? Like, kind of in a nutshell. Does Christology matter when you apply it to specific topics in theological anthropology? Like, not kind of just broad claims about Jesus being important for humanity, but does it actually kind of shape when I talk about the body or when I talk about free will or when I talk about sexuality? Does it actually matter for those kinds of issues? And I landed on the debates about mind-body, body-soul relationships as my test case for my doctoral work. And ended up arguing and have not yet decided that I was wrong, that kind of a Christological approach, and here I'm being informed primarily by Bart, so I use Karl Bart as my dialogue partner for the project. So if you take Bart's version of Christological anthropology, that a Christological anthropology doesn't actually answer the question. that it's not definitive about whether we should be dualist or physicalist or whatnot. What it does do is it provides a Christological framework within which we have to understand the human person that excludes certain ways of understanding human ontology. So there are some that you're just looking at and go, I don't get how those could possibly be Christologically adequate. And it raised really hard questions about pretty much all of the other ones. It didn't say, right, so there are a bunch that I kind of arguing, okay, these qualify as Christologically adequate because they're at least making the right kinds of affirmations. It's just not entirely clear how they're able to do so without their different affirmations kind of bumping into each other in challenging kinds of ways. So it was more of a framework than an answer. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would just say that in terms of the former question, if I understood it right, at what point did Jesus perfect human nature? And I don't think that in the Byzantine theologians, for sure, early theologians or the later Byzantine ones, that question is never clear in the minds of those fathers. To think that Christ at the moment of the incarnation was fully perfected human nature like that, they don't seem to go that way. It seems like the perfection of human nature is gradual and progressive, so that, when Jesus is a child for children, an adolescent for adolescents, an adult for adults, at every stage he heals fallen human nature. When does it become perfected? Well, certainly at the ascension, before he sits at the right hand of the Father. There you have the full paschal humanity. But to say when and how it happened, it's never clear in their minds as far as I know.
I found one of the interesting parts of your paper was about idol and idolatry. The idol represents some characteristic of the god, and the idolatry, and that's valid, and then that's what an idol does. But idolatry emphasizes the idol over and above that which it is supposed to represent, in other words, what God is doing. So my question is, when God brought Eve to Adam, Adam said, this is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, she should be called woman because she came from me, if he is idolatrizing himself as idol. Because he's not talking about, thank you, God, for giving, God made her.
I'm going to say no. I'm just trying to figure out.
Why?
Yeah.
He could have said thank you. Or he could have said, God gave you to me.
for one thing, it would just make a mess out of the narrative. So I'm going to go with no. But I don't know that... we kind of run into similar questions whenever we want to say that creaturely realities have a kind of an instrumental purpose in directing our attention toward worshiping and glorifying God and whatnot. So that I'm to appreciate the beauty of the tree, but the purpose of the beauty of the tree is to lead me into worshiping God. So therefore, is it inappropriate for me to declare the beauty of the tree? There is kind of a certain way of telling that story where it kind of sounds like it is. Like, if I ever just appreciate that the tree is beautiful, then I've broken the chain, that I'm always supposed to appreciate God through the tree in that. And I guess I'm just not convinced by that that's necessary, that there is a legitimacy to appreciating the beauty of the thing that God created. The problem would, of course, be if I ever only do that, right? That's when the link gets broken, yeah. I guess I just don't see it in the narrative that I have to say that Adam doesn't ever, right? Because we don't get much narrative, right? Because right after that, they fall, and then we have all kinds of problems. So I guess I would just be inclined to say that the narrative doesn't, it's not a question that the narrative has, and there's nothing wrong with Adam just appreciating the amazing beauty of this creature that God has made. And whether or not he also did something else, like worshiping God in and through that, or if he would have gone on to do something else if the narrative had continued in unfallen states, I just don't think that's a question that the text is asking.
Does go on to have him accuse God of giving her to him. you know, the woman you gave me.
Yeah, but by that time we're broken, so.
No, I think he was broken before.
Hi, I have something of a metaphysical question for Mark, which is related to the question about participation that was asked earlier. I was really intrigued when you were discussing the relationship between the Imago Dei and the context of the idol in the ancient Near East, and particularly when you discussed kind of the cultic or ritual dimensions in the subtext of Genesis, and how that relates to this idea of the idol or the image as somehow bearing forth the divine presence into the world. And in particular, there's a distinction that's often made, particularly in Byzantine theology, between God's essence and his energies. His energies sort somewhat analogous to how we understand grace in the West. They're the divine operations of God that are fully united to his essence but distinct from it. And in a lot of the Eastern fathers that I've read, you get this sense in which they understand ethics as becoming like Christ or growing into the image of Christ through this infusion of the divine energies that happens in us. And I'm really curious to know, is this something that you see at all in Irenaeus? And I'd also just like to know your thoughts more generally.
Okay. Brad might be able to handle the Irenaeus question better than I do. He does use language that sure sounds deification, theosis to me, just less well maybe developed that you get in some of the later thinkers who really kind of put all the pieces together. I think I used the language of deification at one point in the paper. So Irenaeus reads that way to me. So I would see him as kind of at the maybe not even the beginning, but he's certainly a part of the chain of early Christian thinking and arguing that that's the right way to understand how this kind of all works out. I would need to do more work on the essence energies distinction to know or to kind of draw conclusions about whether I like that better than emphasizing pneumatology in the way that I have tended to do as the right way to locate this particular conversation. That's about as far as I'm going to get on that one. Yeah. I mean, I will need to get into it when we talk about divine presence as it relates to these various conversations, because that is such an important way in which the Eastern Orthodox understand the relationship between God, humanity and God in the process. So to this point, I have preferred to emphasize the presence of the Spirit and to use that language and conceptual framework. But yeah.
If I could do just a little footnote, you said that the grace is like what we mean in Western theology. It really isn't quite that way. Usually Western theology defines grace as unmerited favor. And in St. Gregory Palamas, grace is much different than that. It is that, but it's more than that. It is, and this is, I think, where the Eastern Church really has something to offer the modern conversation, because they developed the notion of grace in a way that probably hasn't been as well developed in the West, and that is that Palamas sees that grace is, in fact, God himself. So that when we speak of God's grace, we're not talking about something that's infused into the human person as if God creates it and gives it, but rather grace is a participation in the divine energies themselves, which are God.
Or you could go with Edwards, who often uses the language of the Spirit to talk about grace, so that to have God's grace is to have the Spirit.
Thank you.
Sorry to steal the mic twice. and to actually direct, I think these questions are, well, the first one is definitely for Wes, but feel free if you guys want to jump in. This is mostly from New Testament perspective. And it's really interesting because, and I think we're friends, so I can say, it's interesting that sometimes like the gaps in our starting points open up. And when you spoke about Irenaeus as being a controversial figure in New Testament scholarship, especially because he doesn't emphasize the radical disjunction that is kind of common in New Testament scholarship, I thought to myself, yes, if you're an apocalyptic theologian, you'd have problems with Irenaeus. But if you, I don't want to use the language New Perspective, but covenantal, write-in, then like he's our patron saint, right? He is our he's our forerunner. And so I wanna ask the question of, am I right in hearing that that apocalyptic readings have more of a problem with Irenaeus than New Perspective readings or Hayesian readings, where we emphasize the narrative? And what does that mean? Does that mean that somehow indirectly, like Wright, who's anti-patristic, has become the, you know, something for who's in connection with the Father? So I'd like to hear you talk about how the different strands of New Testament scholarship do impact how we understand what Irenaeus is doing. And then the second, which may actually not seem related, because it's not, but it's, I thought you guys said it was important. But you had this really interesting discussion about the fallenness of Jesus' will and whether or not he experienced real temptation. And I thought that had a real interesting implications for how the whole discussion around identity and human sexuality that we're having right now, whether or not it's okay to say that I experienced these temptations and they are a steady part of who I am, but I'm not acting upon them. And so how does that entire conversation you guys had about will and Christology impact that present debate, and that's open for anyone, about how people who experience same-sex attraction are describing those experiences? And I don't know if that is somewhere in the conversation I haven't read, but I'll open that up as potential topics as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So I think it goes back before the so-called apocalyptic readings of the New Testament. I mean, one of the things you'll find over and over again if you read kind of the mainstream historical critical New Testament scholarship coming out of Germany, you know, coming out of the Lutheran tradition, is a real nervousness about Luke and Acts in particular. Because if you read Paul, if you read Galatians, you know, this confrontation with Peter at Antioch, this kind of journey to Jerusalem he makes, but they didn't add anything to me. You know, I was already fully an apostle before I met James or Peter. I don't need their stamp of approval in order to be legitimate. A lot of people see Luke as smoothing all that out and producing a much more kind of harmonious picture of early Christianity, you know, kind of editing out the more disruptive elements. So all that comes well before J. Lewis Martin, all that comes well before, you know, Becker and all these apocalyptic folks. And in my reading, Irenaeus is often treated as the heir apparent of Luke, you know, the heir apparent of Acts. He's the one who kind of bequeaths to the church this very linear narrative. But I mean, I have to say, hearing Mark's paper, I don't know Irenaeus well, but that does not sound adequate to what Irenaeus is up to. I mean, that still leaves open the question, how do we talk about discontinuity and continuity between the covenants, between the testaments? And as you know, working with N.T. Wright, and as I know, working with Francis Watson, that's very much an open conversation in New Testament scholarship. How do we both hang on to the fact that the God of Israel is the same as the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, but also do justice to the fact that something radical has happened? The kingdom has broken in a way that in retrospect, we can see deep continuity with the promise to Abraham, with the history God has with Israel. But the very fact that many of the Jews of the first century could not see that continuity, they didn't agree with it, they rejected it, shows that there's something new that's causing a massive reevaluation. So that's, you and I can talk more about that later, maybe. On the second question, yeah, I mean, so I was part of a panel at the Evangelical Theological Society a couple of years ago on this whole question of how do we talk about same-sex attraction? And there were some voices that wanted to say, regardless of whether you're refraining from same-sex intimate behaviors, the very fact that you experience the attraction is itself sinful. And that's the language they wanted to use, sinful. And then other voices wanted to say, no, the proper category for thinking about same-sex attraction is temptation. And like Luther says, you can't help what birds are flying over your head, but you can keep them from building a nest in your hair. You know, there's not a sin to be tempted, but the sin comes in when you choose to nurture and to fantasize and to embrace those thoughts. I think in a lot of conservative evangelical circles, that is very much an open question, you know. I tend to think pastorally, it's pretty disastrous to say to someone with same-sex attraction that The very fact that you are experiencing this, and regardless of what you're doing with your body, the very fact that you have this experience shows that you are already in deep moral compromise. That's a pretty damaging thing, in my view, to say to someone pastorally.
But
I mean, this is not to get too far in the weeds, but yes. I mean, there was a paper at ETS given by Denny Burke where he argued that the uniqueness of Jesus' temptation, the fact that he was not drawn of his own corrupt heart toward the temptation, shows that you can't compare his experience to what Christians are experiencing now in terms of their sexual temptation. So that has been brought in. Mm. I don't know if you guys have anything you want to add to that. That's obviously.
Yeah, only that. So I mentioned in the book where I was dealing with this that the argument that I tried to put forward was a way of saying that Jesus, explaining how Jesus might be able to feel the tug of sin without being culpable. And specifically because I do think, I hadn't thought through it in this conversation, but I would want to say that there are ways in which at least some desires are culpable desires. It's not like my desires are completely out of my control. Yeah. I'd want to think more about like how I want to categorize, like what do you put where and whatnot. But it does seem clear to me biblically that some desires are the kinds of things where the Bible speaks against the desire itself and not just the act of it. Yeah.
I mean, it is striking sometimes how our Catholic brothers and sisters have precisions that I think we could learn from. And one of the distinctions that Catholic theology draws is between what they call the inclination toward an intrinsically disordered moral action. So if the coupling of same-sex intimacy is intrinsically disordered, in other words, it can't ever, regardless of its moral context, it can't ever be properly ordered because inherent in the nature of the act is a disorder. So there's an inclination to that action. And they want to say that inclination is morally problematic. You know, to be drawn to that act is a symptom of the fallenness of the world. But then they want to say that inclination is not reducible to the experience of sexuality. Our sexuality is broader than just what particular behaviors we're drawn to. There's a kind of sensibility to it. And, you know, once you get into drawing those kind of distinctions, I think that's actually really helpful pastorally in terms of how you actually help people who are wrestling with temptation and desire. So for what it's worth.
I'm afraid we have to bring this to a close. Wes, I'm assuming, will be speaking on some of these issues in his presentation tomorrow. Let's thank Mark and our panelists. A couple announcements before we break. Immediately following these announcements, Mark, Gilbert Mylander, and Bradley Nassif will be signing books in the back at the table back.